So the study was basically to take the investigative record that had been created by the lawyers who had previously worked on the matter. And by the way, the two key lawyers doing the investigation had left the staff by that time. Now, they came back, you know, we were consulted with them, but the case was sort of dormant for about 6 months until this happened. And I think the problem was Bill was in, he was in the hospital. He was having problems of one sort or another, and sort of
Bill,
keeping Moran.
Okay, yep.
He was a region administrator. And Bill's an old-timer and a very smart man and a very dedicated guy, but this was probably something he... And we really had no person on the case. I'm not saying that I would have been better or anything like that, but somebody from the staff who'd worked on the staff for some while, sort of working the case along with these new lawyers who are very senior kinds of guys, but they were running into a lot of trouble and then they left the staff. And so the case was in limbo until we got the call from Stanley that we had to do this report. We call it a 21A report.
Okay, yep.
Well, the invasion began. And every day, without stop, we worked. I was responsible for doing the chronology. And the way we did the chronology is we assigned, and there are a lot of witnesses in the case, a lot of documents, a lot of stuff, enormous amount of material. And we had a conference room, a big, it was actually our hearing room. And I gathered in all of about 40 lawyers. And we went day by day, what happened. And we were able, actually it was susceptible to do it that way. And what was produced was this document. This is part of, I just dug this out. This is chapter one, it's called the chronology.
So what's the time frame you're covering here?
Well, the time frame, okay. Chronology of events, October 1, 74, April 8, 75.
Okay.
That was the relevant period.
Okay.
And that was a very crucial time because they were issuing a lot of securities, municipal securities, and yet things were coming out that were known to various people. So each part of this was entailed New York City, the municipal managers from the mayor on down, to the underwriters, to the rating agencies, to investors. I also worked on another part called, I think it was the fraud part, county practices, which there was a limited amount of county. The role of the city and its officials, the role of rating agencies, role of bond counsel. This was the very first time, as far as we knew, that bond counsel had been looked at and to determine their role. And of course, the rating agency, you know, we don't seem sometimes to learn from what we've done in the past, because now they'd say, all these toxic securities, they had AAA, you know.
Yeah.
Well, so did these.
Yeah.
And we looked very carefully at them. Then we had the individual investors and syndicate members, managing underwriters, that whole part. So the upshot of the whole thing is we dissected this group. It was about 50-50. There's about 70, 80 people. Stanley would be there all the time. I would be there all the time. I would go home at night, midnight, 2 in the morning, whatever. We worked Saturdays, Sundays. At that time we had an IBM computer to do the typing. Mm-hmm. We had to have it flown up from Texas. because of the volume of the, you know, we're talking, this is the final product, but we had many drafts and stuff.
Right.
The strain was enormous. It was pretty unbelievable. But it was really, it just shows you what you can do under stressful conditions and get it right. This was, so the Wednesday before the Friday, August 26th, I get a call. And I get, the other guy's name escapes me for the moment, but it's Stanley and another guy. And I say, hello, Don, we got a problem. And then he and the other guy, Stanley and the other guy, are arguing. Now, they're both in Washington. And one's saying, well, we found some errors in the chronology. We found some errors in other back and forth. And we knew one thing. Dennis Block was working for, who had been on the staff, but he was a big pain in the ass in this case. He'd worked for a major law firm. Hi, baby. And they had a whole bunch of lawyers, and they would fly-spec everything because it was politically charged. They found errors. This thing would have no credibility whatsoever. So we had to make sure the chronology was correct. Well, so they're arguing. And I'm so it's about 5 o'clock on a Wednesday before the Friday that this thing was to be published. And they had already had it set up to be printed. So I said, okay, stop. It's getting close to closing time here. I've got to reconstitute the group we're going to have to do this all night just to go through the whole thing again. By that time, we had things organized well enough. And so around 6 o'clock, I stopped people. People, some of them who had not been in the first go-around, they were on vacation because it was summertime.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great, we can start working. And
see you in the morning.
See you in the morning, kiddo. Thank you, Mary.
You did everything.
Okay, you did everything good. Take care of yourself. Yeah, sorry about your...
That's all right. He's old and senile, but...
Well, it's getting like me, yeah. So I literally ran to the front door of the office. This is again at 26. Stop, everybody stop, go back. So I thought I was a crazy person, which I was a little crazy at the time. And so I said to everybody, I said, look, we got to meet. I got to tell you what we have to do. And everybody was just phenomenal again, fantastic. We went through the chronology and found a ton of errors. And we corrected the whole thing. And it was published on August 26th and delivered to the Congress.
So what did Congress do with it?
Well, that's a good question. There was legislation. There was the Municipal Rulemaking Board established. Right. So it did have...
So this was part of that process then?
Right.
Okay.
I am sure that prior to this, yeah, there probably were failures, municipal failures and things. I'm sure that was true. But prior to this, there was nothing that came close. Well, I think that was the beginning of... Now, why is it important? You know, how can we translate this a little bit to make it a little more relevant? I'll tell you why. In 1994, I'm at Merrill Lynch. I went to Merrill Lynch in 1987, right. There's a little thing called Orange County. Merrill Lynch was deeply involved. The SEC was all over us, investigating us, making some very, when I say us, I mean Merrill Lynch.
Right.
I was not directly involved with the case until later on, when I was responsible for 6 of the witnesses and worked with, it was Harvey's firm at that time. I don't know why I get these firms all mixed up. But anyway, It was very difficult.
Fried Frank.
Fried Frank, yeah. It was very difficult on us in terms of, I mean, if we were indicted, you know, all the firms are always scared of that as because it probably would mean you have to go out of business. And a lot of the things, I remember the staff, I said, yeah, I worked on the old New York City case, and they sort of laughed a little bit. They were, it's like, we should have known, but why did you let this happen again type of laugh.
Yeah.
Well, it was really very much of a different kind of situation, but it did involve municipal securities. And that was sort of like step two. And I think we may be going through a step three in municipal financial soundness, I'll call it, mm-hmm. In the current environment. But this was and as a matter of fact, that the work that we did on the rating agencies was I think the first time the rating agencies were looked at, and certainly the first time that bond counsel was looked at. A lot of uniqueness about how this was done and sort of laying the groundwork.
Other highlights of your time sort of going through the New York Regional. You were involved in the Franklin National Bank case?
Yes. Right? Franklin National Bank. It was around 1975 or 6. I don't know the exact year. And I get a call at home on a Saturday. I don't know how they found me, but they did. From the Fed. The president of the Fed.
Hmm.
The Geithner of the Fed at that time. We have a problem with the Franklin National Bank, he said. And could you be here tomorrow? Well, tomorrow was Mother's Day. I don't know if it was May 12th or whatever it was. So I called Bill. I said, Bill, look, this is the 20th largest bank in the country by virtue of deposits. So he said, okay, I'll go pick me up. So Bill and I go in thinking, you know, maybe a couple hours. We get there around 10 in the morning and left at midnight. And what happened was the demise of the Franklin National Bank. And it led to a guy by the name, an Italian by the name of Sindona, who turned out to be a big crook, who was using the bank in one way or another. I can't go into the details, but its assets were put into some jeopardy because of his business dealings.
He was money laundering, right?
Well, he was money laundering, but he was also probably getting loans that he shouldn't have gotten. I mean, a variety of business activities. I mean, monkey business activities. He was later indicted. The people at the Franklin, we brought a case. Again, another one of these weekends, all-nighters kinds of deals. Mm-hmm. We had a large staff on the case. I was, again, the associate regional administrator, but I was calling the shots from what we had to do. And it got a lot of press and publicity at that time.
Why did the Fed call you? Why didn't they call the OCC or somebody like that?
They did. They had them all there. Okay. Everybody was there. That's when I first found out how these banks are regulated. So the stuff that you hear now, I knew that stuff. I knew that there were state regulators. I knew that there was OCC. I knew there was the Fed, of course. I knew that there was, who were the bank? There's another bank regulatory organization. All of them were there. They wanted us because actually we were the tail end of all of this.
Okay.
Because the bank was public, but its securities didn't trade. You know, it wasn't like a Bank of America or Citibank kind of deal. You know, we had a huge trading mm-hmm. situation with a lot of shareholders. But there were some, certainly there were. And what we had worked out I remember the president of the bank being there, arguing about how everything was okay and stuff like this. Well, in our side meetings, usually with the general counsel for the Fed at that time, it was, you know, he said, this is going to be liquidated, this bank. There's no question about it. And we didn't know all the details of Sindona's role, but it was significant. There's no question about it. And that also led to the politics in Italy. Now, I'm not saying we were involved in, we weren't involved in any of that, but it was all part of the significance of the of that case. And because Sindona was well known in Italy as a financier and political connections and stuff. So that came and went. The other thing I would say in the 70s, Dirks. Now, the Dirks case to this day is quite significant because it somewhat defined insider trading. Up to that time, insider trading had been, or up to about 6 months before, or a year before, insider trading had been viewed as more broadly. So that market information was sort of encapsulated with 10b-5. That came to an end in a Supreme Court case in Chiarella. So it complicated our
right.
Stuff. Are you familiar with the Dirks case at all?
Yep.
Okay. We... you're familiar with equity funding and what they did?
With not the fraud? Too much, no.
It's a very interesting story. Equity funding was a mix of mutual funds and life insurance. In other words, it's kind of an annuity mm-hmm. sort of operation. And they ran into trouble. They had set a goal of increasing their business by 15% a year. And they lagged behind. This is early 70s now. And what they had done is they created fictitious life insurance policies. So if you think about what goes into a life insurance folder is, you know, applications and medical reports and, you know, stuff like that. And then what they did is they refinanced, or not refinanced, they reinsured those policies. That's where the fraud really was. And so they, either they sold them or they borrowed money against them. Or they worked half and half. There are different arrangements, but the essence of it is they took the... Now, it's part of the record. Shortly before Jerry Bolts became the regional administrator in Los Angeles, this was a Los Angeles company, there was a whistleblower who went to the staff. This was in 1971. And said they were manufacturing insurance policies. A few calls and nothing happened. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, 2 years later, in March of 73, it blew up. Dirks caused it to blow up. He, and this it only took a few weeks, he was approached by a former employee who told him all the stuff that was going on. That they were creating these insurance policies. They had these fraud parties, and the senior management was directly involved in everything. And eventually they all went to jail, of course. Dirks then went off, and the first thing he did, it was sort of like a fairy tale kind of thing. He goes through his positions. He was an analyst. He was known as a maverick analyst in insurance. Mm-hmm. fields. And he had one big success. There was some hanky-panky with some insurance company a year or two before. So he was a known person in that regard. That's why they went. This guy went to him. Told him what happened. Dirks then calls big holders of the stock who did business with his company, the name of which I can't recall right now, his firm.
Right.
He then visits others in addition to those firms. Princeton University bought over 400,000 shares. Their advisor gets wind of the story and within 4 days' time sells all 400,000 shares. I mean, it's obvious that people were either believing the story, which was not verified yet, or they were afraid that the market conditions, once Dirks started to dribble it out more and more, would cause a sharp decline in the price. He then went to California, Dirks, to pursue his investigation, wound up with a Wall Street Journal reporter, and on March 21st or something, the Wall Street Journal published the article about the... Now, in the meantime, they also spoke to other people, one current employee and several former, who confirmed that they were manufacturing policies. A receiver was appointed, company was liquidated, prosecution.
So when was your involvement?
My involvement came, we started a proceeding against Ray Dirks and the Tippies. The Boston company was one. There were others. I can't recall all the names. There were six Tippies. They were all investment advisors. Consented to a censure. Dirks fought. The first day, January of 1977, January whatever, we started the proceeding in New York City. This is an administrative proceeding. He shows up in a white suit. Symbolically, that I'm the white knight, I broke this open. That was basically his story.
Right.
We won the case below. Judge Markham was the law judge. It went on for months. And I became, what happened is, we had a lawyer who was representing the enforcement division in the proceedings. He left. He's a good friend of mine, but to this day I never forgive him for doing that. He shouldn't have done it. I mean, it was just, in my mind, it was improper. He went to get a job with a law firm that disappeared in a year's time. And you know, I keep reminding him of that. I could have made you famous. So who winds up trying the case? Me. I'm the associate regional administrator. I shouldn't have been trying the case. But we were stuck. There was one other lawyer who was on the case, a young lawyer. And then I enlisted a more experienced, seasoned lawyer to work on the case with sort of three of us. And it was, they've since merged, but one of the large firms in Boston, major, major firm representing Ray Dirks. Let me take that back. They were representing one of the Tippies, but one of the Ray Dirks was represented by a name you should have because he's a billionaire in Texas now. I can get the name for you if you want.
Okay.
Not from the law business, but from mergers, acquisitions, and stuff. He was an excellent lawyer. I can get the name.
Yeah, I can look it up too. It's no big deal.
I have some of the briefs, and I'm sure I have the name there. But in any event, yeah, it's interesting. The boxing promoter in Plone. I mean, yes, how lawyers who are in the securities world, how they sometimes go off in other things. It was appealed to the D.C. Circuit, affirmed, and all he got was a censure. But of course, it became a sort of a cause célèbre. It went to the Supreme Court in a 6-3 decision. We lost. Paul Gonson, you know Paul?
Yeah.
Argued the case. I was there. In the bank, mm-hmm. Still, when I see Paul, not all the time. I say, Paul, we won, and then I guess you lost, right? Is that what happened? The footnote 5 became important.
In the court's decision.
In the court's decision. And what it said is, you don't need to have remuneration to be liable. It could be reputational. And that, of course, evolved from the facts of this case. Dirk's got $2,000. It was sort of thrown at him a little bit. The Boston company was one of the advisors. So they threw him some money, $2,000. Other than that, he received no, and he didn't trade in the stock himself. We had a tough case, you know, thinking about it. So the motive issue wasn't there for us. And that was kind of the basis for it. He was coming across as a white knight. We acknowledged that, but we said that it's improper for a market professional to selectively disseminate material, non-public information emanating from a corporate source. That is, these people. The Supreme Court was not going to buy it on that kind of situation. It was just not going to happen that way. So, but that's what we got out of it. And I think the case has been also prompted the SEC to adopt rules. As we know, there are insider trading rules specifically, you know, with regard to mergers and acquisitions, mm-hmm. and also to hone much better in light of Chiarella, in light of Dirk's decision.
Right.
It's how it views insider trading. Who's liable? Who's responsible?
It's part of that whole evolution, really, of insider trading. Let's move you into the 1980s. You took over the New York regional office in 81, I guess.
Well, let me get a little bit. The next person after Bill was Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just. Steve comes on board. First of all, Bill. The problem with Bill, this really shouldn't see the light of day, I guess, but. You know, Bill really stayed beyond where he should have as region administrator. A wonderful man. You could almost write books about him. Grew up in New York. Went to Fordham Law School. Went to Manhattan College, Fordham Law School. And according to Bill, and I think he's right, he was the first non-Ivy League lawyer hired by the SEC. And the way that happened is he went down to Washington back in the 30s and was coming back on the train and ran into Bill Douglas and struck up a conversation with him that may have helped him get the job.
One would think, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Steve Hammerman.
Steve comes on board in 1979. I had known Steve. He had been one of the hotshot prosecutors. I didn't know him real well, but I knew him well enough, and I had a lot of regard for him. Steve is a very, some would take it as arrogance. I take it as just being a very positive, he's a very bright guy, but he's got a, he knows what he wants. And I, to this day, believe that if he stayed at Merrill, you know, he left at the end of 01, that we wouldn't have gotten into all this trouble that he did. It's a whole other world. If somebody's going to write a book about that, that would be huge, I think. Anyway, January of 1980, Payne Webber. they lose control of their books and records. Now, Payne, that's not one of these little, what I call little schlamazel firms.
Right.
This is, you know, the big time. The stock exchange, Bob Bishop used to run the stock exchange, regulatory. I don't know if that name means anything to you, but he really did a lot of amazing things. Very protective of the exchange. As a matter of fact, what happened is they were converting their books, they were acquiring Blythe Eastman Dillon.
Payne Webber was acquiring.
In January of 1980.
Okay.
They came to see us. I'm not sure I was part of that meeting, but they went to the exchange as they would normally do, and then as a courtesy with us, to explain that nothing can go wrong. Now, you heard of the experiment that United Airlines conducted years ago? They were going to have pilotless planes, and all computerized. And the first flight from Los Angeles to New York, they get on, the announcement was, we want to tell you that we don't have any pilots here, but everything is fine. It's all computerized. We want to assure you that nothing can go wrong, that nothing can go wrong, that nothing can go wrong, that nothing can go wrong. So that's what they were saying to us. And of course, everything went wrong from day one. Also, there was a bad flu epidemic. So a lot of their key people were sick, a lot of their back offices. And they still, you know, Wall Street still had not emerged from, they're not anywhere near the sophistication in their computerization as they are today, certainly.
Right.
So everything went wrong. A large part of what went wrong is not, thank God, the customer side of the business. It was very large trades, contra trades with other brokers, other kinds of arrangements, which involves significant amounts of money. They brought in, I forgot the big consulting firm, but they brought in a big consulting firm. They had like 1,000 people in their back office. I mean, it was just an enormous project. We monitored very carefully, Steve, myself, and our examiners. We would have, if not daily meetings, we would certainly have weekly meetings. And it was a tough time because we took a vote. Should we throw him into SIPC or not? Now, I was, of anybody, Ed Nordlinger headed up. You know, Ed's retired now. Guy I have great respect for, Ed. He said they should go into SIPC and we shouldn't have the responsibility of it. Steve, well, my position, let me say this, my position was, I think we should work with them because the customer calamity would be so great. Yeah, we would sort of offload it and off of our responsibility. Right. That's true. But, it sort of harkened back to the old days when I was sometimes trying to work things out.
Right.
And Steve said, no SIPC. And he spoke to Harold about it. I wasn't on the phone call, but I know, he told me.
Mm-hmm.
Steve used to drive me every night to the train station. Every night we went downstairs, he had a, we still laugh about it. He had a Horizon. It's a Chrysler Horizon, piece of shit. I mean, an orange car. Ellie, his wife, said one day that he was walking someplace, he saw this car, he bought it. I mean, it's just nice. And we used to see Dick Nixon down in the basement because that's where his bodyguards were and stuff. But in any event, so it started to pull out. They started to get control. It was a very expensive, convoluted effort. All we could really do is monitor. I mean, we you know, it's not our place to... they brought in some money. They brought in... I mean, they weren't out of capital. That was the good news. The bad news is you couldn't calculate capital. You know, it's one of those deals where you think you got enough, but you can't prove it. And Payne Weber was saved for another day. That's the way it boiled down.
Yeah.
And to this day, Ed says they should have gone into SIPC. I said, Ed, they survived. He says, well. But that wasn't the only problem we had. There was a little thing called the silver crisis. Are you familiar
with that? Oh, yeah. I remember that one well.
Well, Bache got caught up. Bache and Company got caught up in it. It was the two brothers from...
The Hunt brothers.
The Hunt brothers from Texas. They were trying to corner the silver market. And they got caught up in it. So we had a big meeting. I went to the meeting. It's kind of interesting. I'm a little cynical at times. But the... an ounce of silver had to open the next morning at $8.70. It was something like $8, meaning that Bache, if it didn't open up at 8.70 or better, would be out of business. Well, can you imagine what happened the next day? They opened at 8.70 and the rest is history. Bache survived. Which, when you get to commodities, again, it's not a matter of proof or anything, but it's a matter of, to be a little cynical, you know, obviously, it was obvious to me that whoever was running the market and however it happened, they had to get that market up there. Mm-hmm. Because the Hunt brothers, if they dumped everything... Now, I don't know, you know, there's ways of trading those markets where you're out of, where you're hedging, so you're short, you're long, right. You're all these things, and combinations, and all this kinds of stuff. Which I should tell you, and back up, after I'm through with this, but about something else, but the, so both firms survived 1980. I think Bache was in April.
And the other firm you were talking about?
Well, Payne Weber by March.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
We had a little side note on Payne Weber. It's kind of interesting. The president of Payne Weber, the chairman of the board, you still see him on TV once in a while, Don Marin. Donald Marin? Mm-hmm. You know the name?
Yeah.
Okay. I met with Don Marin a few times. And he was trying to... one time I met with him is the president had sold a significant amount of stock at a time which we thought was a little questionable in light of all of this. And we were taking testimony from him, and I Marin wanted to talk to me about it. And I said, sure. He says, well, what, you know, he didn't intend to do anything. He was building a house or something. And he says, well, Mr. Marin, you know, appearances sometimes, you know, we have to look into these things. I'm not saying there's a case here, but so he was a little upset that we were even looking into it. He should have thanked us for not putting him into SIPC. That's what he should have done, but I couldn't tell him that. You know? So, the part I was going to mention to you, and I have this written down, is going back to the late, in the 60s, and very early 70s, over-the-counter securities were traded sort of by advertisement, the pink sheets.
Right.
The conversion from the pink sheets to NASDAQ As a matter of fact, I gave a speech at the Plaza Hotel about that when they were celebrating the conversion. I think I was at a luncheon speaker. Opened up the over-the-counter market. I mean, if you can see night, the blackest of night, turn into like it is now. That was the difference between how over-the-counter securities were traded. And a lot of fraud, a lot of our business actually came from the hanky-panky that went on. And a lot of it was, it wasn't sort of venal even. It was a lot of, I mean, there was no transparency to speak
right.
of. And also, should mention, in the options market, the options exchanges opened up about the same time. In the early 70s. So you used to see these little ads in the paper for options. Put options, call options. And that all disappeared. Then it traded on just like stocks. And just a little insight at the New York Stock Exchange, they were always thinking, John Phelan was always, he was a fairly conservative guy, one of the more brilliant guys I've ever met. But he was always, you know, what's our silver bullet? I remember we had a dinner one time when I was at the exchange. Let's talk about a silver bullet, about how we can do something dramatically to enhance our situation. And one of the guys said, well, we should acquire an options exchange. And I wasn't well-versed enough to say, geez, I think that's crazy. But the world changed. 1975. Was a huge change. What was it, May 1st?
Yeah, May Day.
May Day. Yeah. So I saw May Day. If you think healthcare controversy was big, that was huge. People had, you see, it just shows how greed can drive things to be done the same way over and over again. The hell with the public. They're paying through the nose for all this crap.
Right, and there's always the case that, well, we don't know what the implications of the change might be, better to be safe, et cetera, et cetera. But let's move you into the 80s and the period in which you're running the New York regional office at this point. How did your, I would assume that you're, you know, you're not sort of going out and doing, getting your hands as dirty, you're administering a larger team, things like that. How did your job change, and what were some of the things that you started looking at that point?
Well, the biggest change is I had to look at things, you know, from 10,000 feet. I had to deal with more people. We were going, the whole SEC was going through some changes. If you recall, we were moving from Harold Williams to the next chairman, who was very good, I thought.
John Chad.
John Chad's famous quote was, we're going to stomp on them with the hobnail boots, meaning insider traders. Mm-hmm. We had a big insider trading case, which really set the tone. John Fetters was the new director of enforcement. This case involved it's the Missouri company.
St. Joe Minerals.
St. Joe Minerals. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you thought of that. But it was the first of a number of cases where trading was done through Swiss banks. One of the Swiss banks, I can't tell you which one, we went in and got an order, a freeze order, and froze $400 million. We were only looking for about $8 or $10 million, but we froze an entire account. Now, talk about getting screams. They handled it very well, actually. Harvey called, he was representing them, so Harvey calls it down. You know, And I said, well, what do you want, Harvey? He says, we got to stop this. He says, oh, well, we'll carve out. We'll have a certain amount. So we eventually worked it out, and we agreed to an order that would get them back to a little more sanity. Hold on. So what was good about that situation is several things. And I thought John was an unusual guy. I don't know if you how deeply you've gotten into John's history and why he left.
I've talked to him actually.
Yeah, but I like John. I met with him. We had problems. He was a very difficult guy to deal with. Not just me, lots of people. Mm-hmm. But I liked his management style. If he could only be what I call a Hamish guy, which he couldn't, he would be fine. He was bringing things, tightening things up, where it was very loose before then. Stanley was over at the CIA. Funny Stanley story. One day I get a call, Dom, I'm in town. I said, yeah, well, great. Why don't you come by? Well, I'm here on a case. I said, what do you mean a case? CIA. So I said, come on over, whatever you want. You need some help? You need an office? Blah, blah, blah. So he comes in with three guys. I said, what kind of case is it? Trying to keep something secret? Trying to, you know. He says, nah, it's an employment case of some sort. It's a mundane thing. But a couple of things. One, this case, and there were several others at that time, we were the first. We were getting agreements with the Swiss that opened that whole door, because we were fighting with the Swiss. We wanted to know all the trading records, and we served subpoena. I mean, it was getting nasty. We were getting after the investment bankers as well as the companies, because a lot of these deals were obviously mergers and acquisition kinds of things. And they were sloppy as can be. We had a big case in our office involving two lawyers for major law firms who were leaking their brothers. I forgot that case. I mean, we brought that one, and we got an injunction against one brother, the worst of the two, and lost the case against the second brother, although the judge... It was sort of with a wink of the eye. He said that, yeah, he had to be doing something wrong, but you just don't have enough evidence to prove it. So there was a insider trading, and the evolution into... We had insider trading cases before, obviously, but it became much more sophisticated. When I got to Merrill, after I left the stock exchange, I went to Hong Kong on a big insider trading case out of Hong Kong. So the whole function of internationalization and the trading, anywhere. And we see case after case now where, they're everywhere. So that was a major, I don't call it awakening, but of evolution or creation of ways in which we went after those kinds of cases. The one other area that was major, and we had cases in our office, was the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And I used to go around giving talks to people who, if talk about another controversial act, who the accountants couldn't stand it. They hated it, because you had to certify that their books and records complied with the act, basically. It was a big deal. There's PLIs runs every year at least one session on Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It's still a major thing. We were bringing Foreign Corrupt Practices Act cases before the act was adopted. We were, we called it something else.
Right.
And then Stanley was, he really deserves a credit for all of that. But so that was part of the part of that time frame So we had a lot of insider trading. We had some Foreign Corrupt Practices Act cases. We had a big case at Merrill Lynch involving two options traders. I've got another case I have to tell you about. I won't have a name for you except Merrill Lynch. But that case these two traders were timing their trades in such a way to enhance their compensation at the end of the year. Bastards. I mean, they were distorting the market in options so that they would show a larger value to their inventory and therefore their compensation. Mm-hmm. The other area was stock loan. Still is a problem. I don't know if we were the first stock loan case, but we certainly did a lot of work and we brought a case against Merrill Lynch. I called Steve up. I remember very vividly. I called Steve, and he knew about the case, you know, that there. I said, Steve, I regret to inform you that we're going to bring a case against your firm. He said, okay. You know, I said, we can resolve it. I'm sure, you know, it's a resolvable matter, but you're going to have a whole new way of operating. You can't do this anymore, what you're doing. Well, it's a pretty corrupt area. It's hard to get rid of that kind of corruption.
Explain this a little bit. You'd have people who would specialize in acquiring stocks to loan, and they would count on the market price falling over the interval of time?
Okay, if you sell a stock short, you have to borrow the security to deliver it to the purchaser.
Okay.
So who do you borrow it from? Well, you borrow it from really agents who located the stock for you.
Gotcha.
That was the trick. Who had the stock in inventory? Because you didn't want to disclose what your inventory is normally, except for stock loan purposes. And of course, it's a big business from the firm's point of view because they make a lot of, you know, they lend out stock, they get a point over market or whatever it is that they make, but it's a very, we had a big business at Merrill on stock loan, but they had been hit with a whole, I hit them, I mean, back in the, maybe that was an 82 case, and they had to, you know, had all these procedures. Merrill pretty much was clean on the thing. It went to other firms.
So ordinarily, the process you describe is on the up and up. Somebody's going out and borrowing,
right.
Finding the stock somewhere, and then you're loaning it.
There's a lot of payoffs involved. Basically, that's what it's, the problem is. You're paying people under the table to do the business.
Okay.
And because the business is so lucrative and it sort of has a lack of transparency that if you did it that way, you know, no one looking over your shoulder, you could make a lot of money.
Okay.
There's a lot of bribery that would go on. Even organized crime was delving into it. I think it's the problem is solved today, but it wasn't easy to solve. But we were one of the first cases in that field.
I don't want to let you go without mentioning First Jersey Securities.
Right, I have that down too.
I think Ann Flannery mentioned that whole story. And the guy, Brennan, I guess, who sounded like
Bob Brennan.
Quite a character.
Quite a character. If he kept a... He had arrogance, and he did things... For example, you didn't have a margin account with him. You didn't want to deal with margin, to buy stock on margin. So you had to pay cash. Basically, his shtick was small new companies, and he would control the market. And one of the things he would do, and he had a number of offices, he would take a block of stock and market it in Philadelphia, let's say, in an office in Philadelphia. And then he'd take that block from the customers and market it in another office. And just move the stock around. Which created a lot of problems. And then also with the issuers, there was corruption with the issuers and how he was getting the business and how he was doing the underwriting. It was doomed to fail. And when we brought the case, administrative proceeding, we could have settled the case, but unfortunately my friends in Washington were not going to go along with it.
Why not?
They thought it was so bad that our settlement was too weak. I tried to convince them that this is a tough case. That we were going to, Brennan was going to be suspended for 9 months. That would have been big. They wanted him barred. I remember talking to Wally Timoney. I said, "Wait, Wally, we can't do this. I mean, let's get on the scoreboard here. And then if they keep running this thing, in a bad way, then we'll..." Well, between a lot of things that they did, including the lost records that were housed in our... I had no idea that they were there, that we allowed them to keep them there. Mm-hmm. But one of the lawyers trying the case said, "Oh, yeah, you can put them someplace." And then, of course, they claimed that they disappeared. And I know Ann looked into it at nauseam, and I think it's her firm belief they never, they took them themselves.
Right.
I've spoken to Ann about this many times. And they were just not to be trusted. They were not to be, and their lawyers were some well-known Jersey lawyers, but it became a bit of a game with them as well. And eventually, after I left, the things fell apart.
Yeah, it took a while. It
took a while. And he went to jail. I mean, he was, there was something in bankruptcy. I think he was, whatever it was he was doing, he was making a lot of false statements. He got like 20 years in jail or something. I don't know. But it was probably the most notorious because he advertised a lot on the Super Bowl. He advertised. And stuff like that. So he was pretty well known, but hard to get.
One last bullet from that period is Drysdale Government Securities.
Yes.
Interesting case there. And was Chase involved? And this is another one of those instances where you're sort of looking at gray area, I guess, and trying to figure out, whether you want to do the drastic thing or whether you want to work something out.
Well, I think there are a lot of cases, most of them are small, where you could go different ways. And I don't recall the too much detail about Drysdale. Did we have... what kind of security did we have?
They were buying government securities, right, ostensibly, and Chase was actually, I guess Chase was buying them through them, ostensibly for a bunch of private individuals.
Right.
And Drysdale was essentially just kept buying and couldn't pay for what they were buying.
They failed.
Right. So the question is, who's going to take the hit?
I'm not sure Drysdale resulted, by way of comparison to today, it was probably pretty small at the time.
Yeah.
But it did have implications for the street. I think it did. And a lot of these cases did in the New York office because, if you look at insider trading, it's pretty sort of standard. People would say, and I think it's true, it doesn't take much to investigate an insider trading case. It's you find out who has the information and you just sort of work your way through all those people, mm-hmm, and you'll find trading going on, and mm-hmm, that's pretty much your case. Some of these cases, like New York City, Drysdale, we also had a case involving Merrill Lynch, a retail case back in the late 60s. which had implications for analysts, because the Merrill Lynch analysts sort of came back to haunt us later on when we had those analyst issues, you know, involving those internet stocks and stuff. Mm-hmm. There was an analyst who was touting Texas Instruments was the name of the stock. And Merrill Lynch just blew this stuff out all over the country. I mean, it was a huge, at the time, it was a huge case. It raised issues about analysts servicing the sales side of things.
Right.
And we were in hearings and eventually settled it. And I came up with a formula. There's so many people involved. We had like 30 or 40 different brokers involved in the case. So anyway.
Next big step to the New York Stock Exchange.
Yes.
Did Mill Batten recruit you to come over there?
No, Dave Marcus did.
Was he running enforcement at that point?
He was running all of regulation. So under Dave would be enforcement, the whole exam area, and then all related areas, rulemaking, admissions, etc. So Dave recruited me in 1984. I went over in February of 1984 with Ed Qualwasser. Ed and I were started the same day. And my role initially was broad, and then it was kind of narrowed to enforcement. So I was the head of the enforcement division.
It would seem to be a pretty big step to bring in two SEC guys at the same time.
They had trouble at the exchange.
What was going on?
They had missed a couple of firms that went into SIPC. Missed in the sense that examiners were examining these firms. One was in Cleveland and one was in St. Louis. And they both went under. Again, they were members of the exchange, but it was the examiner staff that it was perceived that they weren't doing their job.
Okay.
In addition to all of that, enforcement had become rather mundane with some older guys running it, and they needed to have much more energy in that whole function.
So what did you do to provide the energy?
Well, a couple of things. One, I got more involved in cases, certainly the major cases. There was a case, why can't I remember the name? It was like a big check-kiting case. One of the major firms was moving money around from account to account. And I forgot the guy who was in charge at the time, but he was well known. A lot of the cases were not supervisory cases. Go after the little guy who did something wrong, but don't go after the managers. We had to change that mentality. We had to say, hey, and the SEC was pushing us hard.
And there was a mentality.
There was definitely a mentality. We brought cases against more firms. They would bring cases against floor firms before they would bring cases against the upstairs firms. Why? Well, maybe because they had more clout on the board. Because there were more of those. Now, floor firms had people, but, you know, it was like oil and water kind of thing. If you had the floor firms hated the upstairs traders and vice versa. I mean, the upstairs traders probably had more of a case than the floor people, because the upstairs traders are always accusing the floor people of ripping them off, and they probably were to some extent. So there's a lot of, and that's John Phelan, actually, when he took over from, John was able to manage those conflicts and those constituencies pretty well. He didn't expand the exchange that much. He was cautious. But when the 87, you know, October 19th, 80, I was at a PLI conference with the guy who was the chairman at the time, we were talking about it, chairman of the SEC, about, what's his name? I don't know why I'm so bad on names today.
David Reuter?
Reuter. David and I were talking about it. He had just finished a panel. I said, hey, Dave, remember this, that time? Yeah, and he says, yeah, I was, you know, he sort of blown his own horn a little bit, still to this day. Dave must be 80. He says, yeah, I was working with, I mentioned John Phelan. Yeah, John and I, we worked on this thing, and we had circuit breakers and all this stuff. And when you think about it, in a single day, the exchange lost 26% of its value. The prior business day, which was a Friday, which was a triple witch day, it lost about 10 to 15%. People went broke writing put options. That was one of the big things I did at Merrill, was trying to track down all these situations. A lot of them were under investigation by the SEC, because people were writing put options. Now, all of a sudden, I don't know what was I doing? You know, they were making money, and then, of course, they're having the stock put to them, and they went broke. I mean, they just overnight.
So tell a little bit more about the New York Stock Exchange and then the whole enforcement regulation deal. You were it took over enforcement, is that right? And you're talking about these internal conflicts that are, you know, legendary at the stock exchange. What sorts of concrete steps were you able to take to sort of change the structure or change the incentives as far as enforcement was concerned?
Well, yeah, you actually had to work through people like Phelan and others to, you sort of had to sell them on changing the outlook. And what you did is you blamed the SEC for it all. You know, John, we just have to do this. The SEC is all over us. You know, we have to bring more supervision cases. We have to look at, we were looking at controversial things a lot more. When I say controversial, I mean it was controversial only because it involved, you know, entire firms and their conduct.
Big firms.
And that sort of carried on. I mean, it grew and grew. I mean, we were hit at Merrill, and there's a case on it, so it's no... our treasurer transferred a lot of money from the broker-dealer to the parent. And technically, we were out of capital for 3 days. This is at Merrill. And Dave and I worked on this. Not only did we work with the regular, they fined us $250,000, which was more than fair. But internally, we revised the whole process, and eventually the treasurer was fired at Merrill. I think at Merrill, the business people they relied on us tremendously, because they didn't really understand. You know, they wanted to be, you know, they didn't want trouble with the regulators. Mm-hmm. They relied on us, and basically that's, you know, there's so many things that happen at Merrill that the things I can talk about are things that involve the SEC in cases. The one big thing that never was a case was, of course, the limited partnership investigation. And that was publicized, the fact that it was an investigation. We had paid out well over $100 million to customers who bought limited partnerships back in the 80s. This is why it's when I look back at Merrill, it was a great firm. It really and truly was. And there were some people who did some things who brought on risk that we should never have had. It's pretty obvious. But when you see the good side, and then you say, well, we weren't a bad firm, you know, we weren't disliked, the regulators really respected us because they knew they had people like me and Steve and Dave and Dave Marcus and so many others with a deep regulatory background. And when we said, yeah, we got a problem, you know, or we don't have a problem, we were believed because they knew we weren't BSing them. At the exchange, I think what's interesting about the exchange is there was a sort of two problems at the exchange, and this goes way back. One problem with the exchange is it has such diverse constituencies that it's black and white in terms of their goals and objectives. And there's quite a few. For example, the issuers whose stock is traded on the exchange always think that they too are being ripped off by the traders, whether they're on the floor or the upstairs traders, that they're not controlling the market well enough. Obviously, they want a higher price in their stock. We can't give them a higher price in their stock. Sometimes we have to sell. You know, Merrill accommodates did accommodate a lot of institutional buyers and sellers. So, you know, that's our business. And then if we can't, and when I say accommodate, not just execute their transactions, but if there's securities left over, or they want to sell 100,000 shares, we can only sell 80. Mm-hmm. We'll take the 20,000 shares.
You were comparing the exchange, though, and talk about the two problems.
One problem. Yeah, that's one. And the other problem is, you see it, if you turn it on right now, you see some guy walking on the floor of the exchange, and it's just you can roll a bowling ball down there, you know, run a truck through it. In my time there, it was packed with people. And we used to have cases where there were good fights and bad words were used, and decorum was violated because it was so in close quarters and stuff. So what was the concern? The concern is that they don't need most of those people. This goes back a long time now. You know,
and those people knew it.
They damn well knew it.
Yeah.
And also there was an element of corruption on the floor. They're floor cases. Where their pricing mechanism broke down. And some of it broke down because of existing positions in a stock. If their specialist had a position in a stock, they're trying to make, you know, to keep their value in their own positions. And they may have to do things that were not entirely kosher to do that. There was this big scandal. I mean, you probably have heard about it. You know, the U.S. attorney indicted a few people from the floor. Most have been acquitted, actually. But there's always this belief that floor activity has a certain element of corruption, of which there's some element of truth to it. But the fact that they're not going to be around that long is that just weighed heavily.
So that was palpable when you were there.
Sure. Definitely there. And also competition. There were Bernie Madoff had a company by the name of Cincinnati Stock Exchange. And the first time I heard of Bernie Madoff was in connection with Cincinnati. But there were other firms that had these, basically they're matching buyers and sellers. And they did it you had to be sort of a member. And our effort was to try and get them all registered as stock exchanges. They weren't registered as stock exchanges. Mm. And so that was very convoluted and controversial. But it all goes back to this It's sort of like what we're going through today, where computerization is shrinking the workforce, and that's what's happened to the to the stock exchange.
But computerization would have helped enforcement, though, as well.
Sure.
Was this something that you were dealing with when you were in there? Were you taking advantage of this?
Well, we had what I always thought of as good computerization for a long time at the stock exchange on a market surveillance. Market surveillance would, I mean, they had a regime that they would follow in the event that there was an announcement. They monitored all the announcements, all of the trading in those companies, and then if there was anything suspicious, it would be turned over to the SEC. And that worked pretty well. I mean, that was and they had enough computerization. I mean, the SEC may have had some problems in dealing with all those cases and how they investigated them and stuff, but I think from the New York Stock Exchange's point of view, the other thing I think at the exchange, and seeing it on the Merrill side, because I used to deal with the examinations. There are two types of examinations, sales practice and what we call FinOp, financial and operations. And they did a pretty good job, the SEC. And more importantly, I mean, since we were a member firm, the New York Stock Exchange. They had unlike the SEC examiners, who are not as good as they should be. They just can't hire good people. That's their problem. It's all a civil service kind of deal. With us, us being the New York Stock Exchange, we could hire quality people with degrees, with experience in back offices, etc. And we had a very good. Yes, there were a few failures here and there. But in the main, it was a very, very astute group of people who were examining firms for FinOp and sales practice. Much better than the SEC. SEC used to do oversight exams of the stock exchange. They rarely were able to make any headway. I mean, you know, they always find a little thing here and there. But the New York Stock Exchange, I think when it became a business, and less of a regulator, self-regulator. You know, they're getting away from that now. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be called a self-regulator anymore.
Right. They've got another word for it, which I can't remember what it is. But yeah.
But that's, I think, from a business perspective, they were happy to dump that because it was expensive. From a credibility point of view, I still, maybe a little naively, believe that it helps the reputation of the exchange to have, you know, really good regulatory controls and good people at the helm in that area.
Of course, they're still regulating the floor.
They're still regulating the floor, and Robert Marchman is there doing it. I saw Robert, by the way, at the PLI session. He's very, very good. I mean, he's really very, very good. I think, you know, our markets are really so institutional now. I mean, you know, these institutions, they watch what goes on. Mm-hmm. They can tell you faster and better what's happening than anybody. They call the people on the floor. They call, you know, they've got their own tentacles out there. And so they're pretty knowledgeable about what's going on in the trading world. And they have people, you know, their own employees that monitor very closely. Because they have a fiduciary duty to their, you know, to right. their clients, obviously. But so I think, I don't know, I wasn't, you know, this creation of FINRA, I'm not sure I... You know, there's good things and bad things about it, in my opinion. But, I mean, it's not so bad to have competing regulators. I think there's some advantage. Mm. Mm. It's more costly, though.
Any other big issues during your exchange years?
Okay, my exchange years, then I want to just quickly show you something. The exchange years...
churning was something that came up a lot. It seemed to be, that seemed to be picked up all the time in the mid-80s. And that was the period when you were...
Well, I would say, under the rubric of sales practice, you have... I think for the first time, people were really getting much more sophisticated on suitability. Churning is a suitability question. Can the account handle the kinds of trading? There are accounts that want to do that kind of trading.
Right.
So you have to figure out, are they sophisticated enough? Do they get the right advice? What's the P&L on their accounts? How well are they actually doing? So I don't see churning so much as suitability. Suitability is still, as a matter of fact, it's part of this legislation, the one that's pending in Congress now. The idea that that brokerage firms are fiduciaries, they make them all a fiduciary. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so that goes to the suitability question of, if the activity in the account is suitable, then even if you apply a fiduciary standard, you've met that standard. I think churning is another way of saying the broker wants to build up his commission business. And of course,
right.
Okay. And I'm not, that is a problem, but I'm not sure that's the biggest of problems. Mm. I think the biggest of problems, if you really get down to it, and it's not been resolved yet, since so many investors buy mutual funds, the costs involved. Now, again, mutual funds are not traded on the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, some closed-end funds are. But I think in terms of the exchange, in terms of the sales practice side of things, we would deal with a broad variety of things. Options trading, even over-the-counter trades, because if it was done in an account of a member firm, mm-hmm. we have jurisdiction over that. A lot of the things that we dealt with were mechanical in the business. For example, we had to deal with these states and the CRD system. How much goes out on the CRD system? So there's friction there, because if you had a broker had a lot of accounts, well, can expect a certain percentage of complaints. Should that go out to the public?
Mm-hmm.
There's always that kind of stuff. Insider trading generally went over to the SEC, that whole category. We would deal with a lot of exam reports where there were operations, if we want to call it just plain old operations, had a lot of cases involving operations against the firms. I think that had a major impact on how firms both staffed themselves, computerized to prevent violations and detect them earlier, that sort of thing. It tightened up that. The back office had been the stepchild of the street. The poorest pay, least educated people, etc. And the first to go when there were cutbacks. And I think that area has been elevated quite a bit, in my opinion. I mean, you got a lot of computer geeks that are running back offices,
right.
The minute you think about it.
Right. Well, anything that we haven't talked about that we should...
Yes, one last item, and it's not a major thing, mm-hmm. but there was a time back in the... I would say the late 70s, early 80s, when staff misconduct was used as a ploy to defend. So even PLI sessions were sort of teaching, you know, how do you attack the staff of the SEC? It was quite popular. We had, I remember we had a big meeting with lots of different people from the inside and the outside to talk about that issue with Stanley in charge of the meeting. And some real concerns that, you know, and there were a few cases that sort of fueled that thing. But it became popular to accuse the staff. And we had some issues in our office evolved and weren't pleasant. And it's all in this idea of attack. Today, you don't want to do that. Then, for whatever reason, I don't know what the reason is, to be honest with you. It was staff misconduct that we're talking about 30 years ago. But if you talk to Stanley about it, or talk to somebody else who, were, you know, in a broader way, were dealing with it, I think they could tell you some, give you some issues about that.
Well, terrific. I appreciate all of your time, and it's been a lot of fun.